Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, too much show to even tell you about, but I'll try. I'll tell you Jeff Foxworthy's coming on, but also tell you I got Mark Garagos to call in and tell us all about this Nicholas Sandman situation and the settling with CNN and CNN settling with him and how that all works, and he'll unpack all of that for us. First, I'll tell you about Meguiar's. Car waxes have come a long way. Last year, Meguiar's introduced hybrid ceramic spray wax. It's so advanced. It's the SiO2 hybrid technology. Delivers ceramic wax protection and durability. No rubbing, curing, or buffing. Provides extreme water beating action. This year, Meguiar's launched their liquid version. Seals the paint for long-lasting protection against the elements. Easy to use. Apply like traditional liquid wax. Also, hybrid ceramic spray detailer. I love the spray detailer. You people, no need to really go wash your car in the driveway and waste all that water. You can park it in the garage and just detail it out with Meguiar's. Removes contaminants like dust, fingerprints, bird droppings, and boosts gloss, enhances protection. Oh, it's ceramic made easy. It's Meguiar's.
Coming to Live by Live Thursday, July 30th, Darius Rucker's Darius and Friends virtual concert benefiting St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Catch an exclusive one-time-only performance by Darius Rucker live from the Grand Ole Opry stage, featuring guest appearances by Clint Black and Tracy Lawrence. All proceeds from the show benefit St. Jude, so get your tickets today at livexlive.com/Darius and tune in July 30th at 8 p.m. Eastern only on Live by Live.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is The Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, Jeff Foxworthy, and New York Times best-selling author, Maria Konnikova. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, Mark Garagos stops by, and Cousin Sal joins in on good sports. And now, if he hadn't grown up in California, he might have been a redneck. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for telling a friend. Love that about you. Right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
Handball, Brian.
Where is comedy today?
Glad you asked, Mark.
I hit Garagos last second because I was seeing some activity on the computer last night, and there was people trying to figure out that CNN, and they settled up with Nick Sandman and the kid from the Covington whatever high, and then the elder, the veteran Indian guy on the steps and the thing, and now everyone's having to cut him checks because they cooked the videotape. But there's a lot of speculation, you know, how much. You know, he sued for $250 million. That doesn't mean, you know, I don't think it's Mark will probably tell you that you don't take a percentage of that. It's just the number they chose. You know, I think we make the mistake sometimes where we go, he sued for 250. If he got half that, that's a big payday. And it's like, he didn't get half that. But Mark is pretty uniquely qualified to weigh in on a few of these things. And also, the question is not only what he would speculate that payday might be, but also why is CNN settling? Are they settling because it's a nuisance? Are they settling because it would cost more money to go to court? Are they settling because during discovery they found something? So I'd be curious what he knows or what his insights are for that. So we'll talk to him in a second. There's NBC is on the way, and ABC and CBS, New York Times, Rolling Stone are some of the publications this kid's going after, or
and
him
think,
and his lawyer.
I guess we'll ask Mark, but in terms of dominoes, even if maybe they feel they're right, once they see CNN say fine, maybe they'll all just say fine because they don't want to be the one left standing.
Right. I don't know. It's probably case by case. I think they'll weigh it out and they'll figure it out. But I don't know. I don't know if you settle because during discovery there are things that you're going to find that are going to look worse than what we have now, which is settling, or if it's just a nuisance thing. But on the other hand, if you run a business and your business does corrugated tin roofing materials and you get sued, then it's just a straightaway decision about money and court and how much your lawyers are going to cost and stuff like that. If you're a news organization and you get sued, you have to think about reputation when it comes to settling more than just a bottom line, because there's a number amount that could probably be assigned to the reputation part. So I wouldn't think news companies would just be in the business of settling up,
or make it go away.
Otherwise they'd get sued, probably get sued every third story they did on somebody. Someone would hit them with a lawsuit and get a check from them. So I don't know. We'll get into all that with him. I'll be curious. Yes.
Also, this may be a naive question. Maybe I'm missing something. But why? What is the point of ever having like he won an undisclosed amount of money? Why don't they just tell us?
Well, I think part of the negotiation is both sides don't want you to know what that number is. Well, I would guess if you're the 18-year-old kid, you don't want everyone to know you just got $61.2 million. Like, you don't want everyone coming to you wanting you to buy you a Cadillac or whatever that is. If you're the news outlet or the entity, you don't want people knowing, let's just say, $10 million. Jeez, and you go, $10 million? Those guys did a hatchet job on my story, you know, 2 weeks ago. That's good for $5 million. Like,
I don't think I know what I can get.
I don't think you want to set a precedent or baseline for the public to go. And then also, there's just a general thing about money. Like, nobody wants anyone to know how much this person has or whatever. Like, remember how devastated we were when we found out that Weird Al's net worth was the same as mine? That was devastating, right?
Over it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying.
I covered all my mirrors for a week.
Yes. I was also...
I got Garagos coming in.
Oh, you got Garagos, so we'll get him on. Also, I know how to get Garagos fired up because his camera's always Dutched when he pops on. But I wanted to get a goddamn haircut before I went to Texas, and then I realized I can't because the sports clip place is closed where I live. It's just all the haircutting places are just closed, except where I'm going to go to LAX and I'm going to get on a Southwest flight with 103 other people in a tube, in an airplane that has less square footage inside of it than the fantastic sports clip place does in La Cañada. But for some reason, that business is shut down. I did it in Houston. They social distance everyone. They put masks on everyone. They give hand sanitizer. They checked your temperature. And then you went in and got a haircut 6.5 feet away from someone else who was getting a haircut. What the fuck? Mark, sorry.
Wait. You know, I was there this morning at the sports clip place, couldn't get my haircut, so I bought clippers and had somebody do it here.
As an attorney, can you explain to me why Southwest Airlines in Los Angeles can put 100 people on a plane and fly them to Texas times 10 times a day, but the sports clip place can't be open?
Not only can the sports clip place not be open, I've got a wedding events planner who wants to put on weddings outdoors, mind you, 50 people or less, and I can't get the deputy attorney general to agree to that, number one. Number two, every single piece of guidance they will give for everything else, meaning you can do outdoors, you can do this, he's willing to comply with all of that. They won't do that. Then yesterday or the day before yesterday, San Francisco Chronicle had a headline, something about they wanted to get married, and now look what happened. And I read it to see what happened. I'm figuring, you know, like 18 people had died and were hospitalized. Turns out 8 positives or something like that. Nobody hospitalized, nobody died. But the headline would make you think that they had had a hot cluster. So you explain it to me. You can't go to the beach, but you can go indoors for certain things. You can't go outdoors for certain things. As soon as somebody would admit that they have no clue as to the science, I think it would be a lot better.
Okay, I completely concur. So this Nick Sandman case, lawyer Lynn Wood. Do you know Lynn Wood?
I talked to Lynn over the weekend, in fact, trying to get him to come on to Reasonable Doubt this weekend. Right after it was announced, I gave him a call and talked to him about it. He will not tell me how much, which is everybody's first question. But I will tell you, having done a mediation recently where I was offered nuisance value, nuisance value is in the eyes of the beholder, because that's the speculation amongst everybody right now, is that he settled for nuisance value.
Yeah, nuisance value would be the low end of a payout or settlement, right?
Well, but part of what people talk about when they talk about nuisance value is cost of defense. What is it going to cost to defend the case? And that can vary wildly. I've seen people estimate it could cost $150,000 to $250,000 to defend a case. I know that it's certain big firms to defend a case is a bare minimum, $1.5 million to $5 million to defend the case, attorney's fees, experts, things of that nature. So then there's the opportunity cost of whoever it is that's going to have to testify at the trial, and the roll of the dice as to the cost-benefit analysis of settling for a fixed amount as opposed to not. So when people say nuisance value, it depends on that. Remember, Washington Post is owned by, I think last time I checked, the wealthiest man in the world. So nuisance value to him might be the sum total of somebody's career earnings.
Do they do discovery before they arbitrate? So is it when entities this large settle up, is it right to think that maybe they found something that wouldn't look good, an email or of something of that nature that wouldn't look good in court?
We talked about, remember when I think CNN settled, and in fact, Lynn Wood, who's the lawyer here for Nicholas Sandman, has been getting into on Twitter some fights with Brian Stelter, I think over at CNN, because Stelter was suggesting it was nuisance value. My guess would be Stelter has no idea what it was settled for, because if he did say it was nuisance value, that in and of itself would probably violate the confidentiality. Generally, they don't settle unless there's some document or something that exposes them to some kind of liability. So generally, I think we speculated before with CNN, would that have been some kind of an internal email? Would that have been some kind of somebody? Remember, Adam, I think you played on ACS, some kind of somebody. Was it Project Veritas who had done a Sub Rosa tape of Zucker talking to various people and saying, I don't care about this, just, you know, we've got one mission or something like that. Or an internal email that says, I don't care what the other side says. This is the attack we're going to take. Stuff like that that gets you over the hurdle of malice and shows that there was some other agenda going on that could expose
you. Would you think once, first off, would they have any privy to the information of what the last entity settled for?
Yes, they very well could. I will give you an example. I'll try to strip it of who knew, but I was up against a very large entity, very well funded. I was representing somebody who had kind of the wind at their back. There was basically a whistleblower, and the person sent over to somebody connected with the client documents that exposed, you know, kind of, I remember the Russell Crowe film that 60 Minutes did a piece on, and they did a movie about
the insider?
Where the whistleblower.
What was that?
Yeah,
the insider. Michael Mann.
That happens quite a bit. In fact, I saw today that the whistleblower in the Novartis case on a $600-some-odd million settlement, the whistleblower got cashed a check for $100-some-odd million. So that happens quite often, where there's somebody inside who doesn't like what's happening and will surreptitiously get the documents to somebody else who's connected with the proceedings.
Do you have a guess on what the amount would be, or what would it be if you represented Nick Sandman? What would you be thinking about?
Well, they had eight different defendants in the crosshairs. I always thought they wanted to pick one off because there's kind of a domino theory. Once one person settles, it sets it up for subsequent settlements. I said before that I thought that the CNN settlement was not what most people would think is nuisance value, and they probably found something in discovery. It's pure speculation. I'm just basing that on 40 years of doing this kind of stuff. My guess would be that you're looking at seven figures. I don't think Lynn, remember, Lynn Wood has got more than enough money. Lynn Wood represented famously Richard Jewell, represented, we mutually represented Gary Condit and Gary Condit's wife 20 years ago or 19 years ago. He represented Ramsey's,
right?
Yeah, the families there,
right.
and did quite well there. He's had kind of a cottage industry of suing tabloids for saying crazy things about people, or suing other kinds of media outlets for suing. So I don't see where he would have wanted to just walk away from something for, you know, what most people are speculating. I don't believe for a second that it's 25, 50, or 100,000 like I've seen on the internet today. That would shock me. I just can't imagine that would be the case. I could be wrong, but it doesn't make any sense to me. I think it would be crazy. My guess is that what happened is that there was a settlement, that the settlement was large enough, probably that they waited for Sandman's birthday, 18th birthday, so they didn't have to do what's called a miner's compromise. That's just a guess. I don't have any information, but I don't think it's a coincidence that he turns 18 and there's a settlement of some kind, because you don't want to have to go and file with a court and tell them how much you're getting and have a judge kind of wave his bless the settlement. So you'd wait until he's 18 and then you would settle the case. And that's, I think, what probably happened here, although you'll never get it out of Lynn. As they come.
Did he seem like he was in a good mood when he spoke to him?
He was in a spectacular mood, and it might have been alcohol fueled. I don't know.
You,
I don't want to accuse him of that. But
and then what about the difference between a company that does construction supply settling and a company that does news settling? Is there a difference? I mean, is CNN going to invite more of these attempts at the more lawsuits, or does it hurt their reputation, or what? How do you factor that in?
Well, there's, you know, that's what we used to call the Ralph's theory. You know, Ralph's supermarkets used to pay off slip and falls, $1,500, $1,000, whatever it was, $2,500. They just didn't want to deal with it, figured it was cheaper than a cost of defense. What they ended up seeing, though, is that there was a proliferation of lawsuits. So they finally got a new general counsel at one point. I think it was Ralph's, could have been Albertson's, who knows, but the principle's the same. What they did is they took a kind of a no settlement policy, and they took a couple of them to trial. Once they won, or defense is what they call it, then people or plaintiff's lawyers who work on a contingency were going to think twice before they brought it. So there is that, you kind of condition people as to what to do. One of the areas of the law right now where there's a lot of trolls are the self-styled ADA type lawyers who sue because somebody wheeled into a restaurant and the handrail was a half an inch out of whack and I couldn't reach the paper towels or this or that. And if you don't pay those off, they won't proliferate, has always been my kind of opinion. And it really does a disservice to the places where there is a legitimate complaint, as opposed to one that's lawyer-generated and looking for fees or a quick hit.
Mark, we appreciate you chiming in. Jeff Foxworthy's on hold, so I'm going to bring it home. Brian,
you got
have
a bigger name on the other
You
one.
Have a question? Did I miss anything?
If it's too low, forget Mark, please forgive my ignorance and try to keep your answer short if you can, because, you know, Foxworthy is waiting. Please explain, what are these news organizations accused of, and what is Sandman suing for? I feel ignorant about this, the whole beginnings of this case.
So they generally sue for a defamation or a libel, sometimes for an intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's a real stretch generally, because it requires all kinds of elements, but there's it's always that you're casting somebody what's called in a false light. So it's very hard. There's a high hurdle in the U.S. as opposed to Britain, which is one of the reasons that Johnny Depp is suing in Britain. There, you have to show that there's some kind of malice. Well, that's why I keep talking about some kind of a smoking gun or a document or internal communication. If it looks like there's an agenda, that there's somebody's carrying water for one side or the other, and you get you're able to tag them with that, that gets you over what's traditionally been this New York Times versus Sullivan case, which is the case that kind of established the high bar that you have to get over.
Right. So if it's just an error or mistake, or you're rushing to get this videotape on the air by 9 a.m., then there's not a whole lot of lawsuit there, right?
Right. And you have to make a demand for a retraction, and they'll give a retraction, or there's a safe harbor where you can go in and get a retraction, things like that. By the time you get through doing all of that, that traditional dance, absent something that gets you over the bar of malice, it's extremely difficult to prevail in those cases, which is one of the reasons why Lynn has been so successful. He's been able to get results in cases that most lawyers would shy away from.
I'll give you a plug. Reasonable Doubt, best hour in the universe, Saturdays on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One as well. And the book, Mistrial, An Inside Look at How the Criminal Justice System Works and Sometimes Doesn't, voiced by our own Dawson. That's available at Amazon right now as well. Thanks, Mark. We'll see each other soon, I hope.
I hope so, too. Bye, Adam.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Gina.
Bye.
Well, I told you, he knows things, and that's why
he
you
knows
go,
everything.
That's why you go to Mark. All right, so we're all caught up on that. We'll keep you posted, and we got Jeff Foxworthy. Oh, there he is. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Say hi to Gina and Bald Brian.
Hey there, y'all. How are you?
Hey, very well. Being here.
The show, What's It Worth, premieres this Tuesday, August 4th, 9 p.m. on A&E. Jeff is sort of going to remotely go around the country and figure out what people's collections and stuff and things are worth. I guess kind of an antique roadshow kind of vibe, right?
Little bit of that vibe, but in somebody's home, which to me, you know, the comic in me, that made it fun. Because right. I'm like, all right, once you let me in the front door, I want to know the dog's name. I want to know the story behind the picture on the wall. You know, right. One couple we were talking to had a statue in the living room. And as they're trying to show it to us, their kids are running around screaming. And the youngest one decided, hey, now would be a good time to take my pants off and run up and down the stairs. And, you know, I mean, it's not stuff you get every day on TV.
For you, when did the comedy bug bite you? Did you know you were going to be a comedian at a young age? Was it part of your life? Where? Because I know you grew up in blue collar, pardon the pun, but I mean, you know, they always talk about, like they go, well, a young Hispanic girl needs to see Hispanic women being doctors so she could understand that one day she could be a doctor. And I don't know. Maybe you're from a place where a lot of your friends and neighbors weren't particularly, and parents weren't into comedy or doing comedy for a living. But how did you grow up?
No, I mean, I really think it, because I do on me and Larry the Cable Guy have a radio station on Sirius, and I do a show called A Comic Mind, where I just talk to comics. And my first question always is, do you think you're born funny, or is it something you learn? And I truly am of the belief you're just born this way. It's like somebody that can open their mouth and sing. You learn early in life, I have this power, you know, to make people laugh. And so as a kid, I would save my allowance and I would buy, you know, God forbid, Bill Cosby records and Flip Wilson and Bob Newhart, and then later, you know, Pryor and Carlin, and I would memorize them, and I would go to school and do it. And I can remember being a kid, and my parents would watch The Tonight Show, and I would lay there in bed and listen to it. And if there was a comic on, I would get out of bed, and I would peek through where the door was cracked because I wanted to watch Bob Hope or George Gobel or Rodney or whoever. So I was always fascinated by this thing. I just didn't know. For a kid from a blue collar town, that was an option. I didn't know that was something you could be when you grew up. And yeah. So I got a job working at IBM, carrying a tool bag, fixing machines. And I was the funny guy at work. I was the guy that was in the break room doing impersonations of the boss, And, you know, the boss would be in the doorway. So it wasn't like I was on the fast track there, but a bunch of guys I worked with used to go to the local comedy club, and they kept coming back to work going, Foxworthy, you're funnier than these people are. You need to go do this. And they actually entered me in a contest, not an amateur night, a contest for working comics. And I wrote 5 minutes about my family. And my first night, I won that week of the contest. And I knew a minute into it, I'm like, hell, I'm quitting my job. This is what I want to do. I was scared to death, but it was like, I found what I am. This is where I fit.
Yeah, I agree. I think we graft too much psychology onto guys with a sense of humor, and we don't do it, as I always say. I always remember I interviewed the great Tommy Lee from Motley Crue many years ago on Loveline Radio, and I said, what's up with drumming? Like, when did you know? I said, when I was five, I was banging on pots and pans. That's what I did. I was five years old, and went in the kitchen, I got wooden spoons, I started banging on pots and pans, and we understand it for artistic endeavors and musical endeavors and singing and things of that nature. Even people that like kids or like working with kids or like gardening or whatever. But for somehow with comedy, we go, oh, you must have suffered a lot of trauma, or you weren't paid attention to in grade school, or your mama didn't establish enough eye contact with you. And it's like, no, just have a sense of humor, just like a musician wants to play, and I don't play the drums. You know, I don't think there's much more reason to look at it that way. And then look at all these poor countries that have all these real problems. Not a lot of comedians coming out of those places.
No, and you're right. To that theory, there should be. I remember the old cassette tape recorders. I mean, they were kind of big, and you'd lay the thing in there and you had the big buttons. And I think I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and I got one for Christmas. And the first thing I did with it was I went and got 2 empty milk jugs, filled them full of water. And then I recorded myself with the alarm clock going off, me getting out of bed, the footsteps walking into the bathroom. You can hear the seat going out. And then very slowly, I empty one of these things of water. And at first, people are snickering a little bit. But when it goes on for 5 minutes, they're howling. Then you have a few drops and it stops. And then I start with the second gallon of water. And, you know, the adults were howling. And I'm like, crap, this is power. This is, you know, I don't know why I'm able to do it. I can't even be cocky about it. But, you know, it's like you just know, yeah, I can do that. I can't figure out what's wrong with the internet. But if you say to me, write me 50 jokes about aunts and uncles, I'm like, okay, I can do that.
The thing that's kind of interesting is if you just step back and watch kids, whatever their interests are, they just present themselves, right? So,
yeah.
If you think of anybody, I had comedy albums when I was a kid. I had like George Carlin comedy albums. I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything. I would listen to Dr. Demento on Sunday nights. I think it was KMET maybe, or KLOS out here. But I'd listen to Dr. Demento religiously. I would record Dr. Demento with a little cassette tape and, you know, literally just hold the unit to the speaker. And I had 2, maybe 3 George Carlin albums that I would just listen to over and over again. And if you think about it, whatever that thing that your kid, and then there are other kids that have no interest and they never bought a comedy album. So young Jeff Foxworthy and young Adam Carolla were listening to comedy records. So you could have ascertained that that 10-year-old was very much interested in that subject. Now, I get it when you're 5 or 6, you play cowboys and Indians or something. It doesn't mean you're going to grow up to be a lawman. But what I'm saying is kind of watch your kids. The stuff all just kind of presents itself.
Absolutely. And to the point, mine are both in their mid-20s, but I think back to what they're interested in as 10-year-olds is kind of what they do now. You know, my oldest one was always about like kind of the underdog and all. And you know, she works in a homeless shelter. You know, so got a master's degree and works in a homeless shelter. And my youngest one was always like drawing and funny. And she played Sims on the computer, you know, putting houses together. And she works in a like a interior decorating place. And you're like, well, hell yeah, she does. She was doing that when she was 10 years old. So yeah. I'm with you. I totally agree.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if comedy, and also I think maybe this helps our argument. Comedy is not really a family business. I mean, there's such a thing, but it's not like just, you know, hey, this is the business of comedy. Come join me.
Not young, everybody's the Stillers.
Young person. Yeah. Yeah. So your kids do very sort of straight type jobs. Do, it's interesting. The other thing that's interesting too is if your parents have some money, you have the freedom to kind of figure out what you want to do. You know, you don't have to go work on a tuna ship in Alaska. You have some money. you don't have to take, I mean, think about all those jobs we all took out of necessity that had no, we had no reason to do them other than pure desperation. Nobody wants to clean carpets or work at McDonald's. I think,
but you're right. And I think back at the time that I did that, I wasn't married. In fact, I met my wife the first night I went on stage. She was there. She was acting, and she had just done a thing with a guy that was a comic, and they had all gone there to root for this guy who I beat in the competition. So I met my wife and my career within 2 minutes of each other, same place, same night.
This person that signed you up, are you giving them 15% of everything you made?
No, I'm not, but I tell them thank you every time I see them. But if I had been married and had kids at the time, I probably wouldn't have quit my job at IBM to be a comic. You know what I mean? Because Lord knows, I mean, that first year I found, Adam, you remember the old, like the little calendars that you would write all your gigs in and you keep them. I found the one from my first year on the road. I did 406 shows and I made $8,300.
Wow.
So it wasn't like I was doing it for the money. I just did it because I loved doing it. But if I had been raising a family, you know, I couldn't have done that. So,
but, you know,
it was having ability, and also the opportunity came at the right time in my life.
How old were you when you went out and did that competition?
20, 25.
It's funny. I was always very consciously thinking, don't have kids. I wouldn't even buy a truck with a payment. I would buy trucks in the recycler for $1,800, you know, used Datsun pickup trucks and stuff. And I could always remember people on my job site saying, go down to Galpin Ford, you know, put down $1,000, make your payment on a new Ranger. I was like, if I have a payment, if I have kids, if I have a wife, I won't be able to go out at night and do this. It would be irresponsible for me to spend my money on groundlings classes when I should be spending it on food and insurance and the stuff you need. And I couldn't quit my day job. And I'd always thought about that long and hard. And I wish more people in the United States would think about how that sort of pertains to them.
Well, yeah, because once I did that, you know, my daughter was asking not long ago, she said, well, did you and mom have a medical plan? I said, yeah, it was don't get sick. You know, we had no money, but I was willing to roll the dice. So I was willing to do anything once I found this. I mean, you know, when we moved to LA, we lived in a studio apartment that if you took your shoes off, the place was dirty. I mean, it was the smallest, and we could have cared less because, you know, hell, we're doing this thing. It was fun. It was like an adventure. And I don't even know back then if I ever really had thoughts that I was going to be successful at it. I just had found something that I loved and I could still eat and do it.
Yeah. I, you know, it's interesting people that there's a fine balance of planning and then expecting too much. Like, having a plan is good, but most successful people I know never had a plan. And also, how close to their plan would their life have mirrored, even now that they're successful? You know, I do podcasting for a living. Podcasting didn't exist. What could my plan have been? You know, and I always just thought about moving forward, not really without a plan. I feel like a plan, sometimes you can get tangled up in it.
Or, you know, like my plan when I start, I wasn't one of those people that got into it thinking, oh, I'll get a sitcom or a movie out of this. I just truly loved stand-up. And so, I mean, and I did those things, but it was almost by accident. But I wanted to be on Johnny Carson before Johnny retired, and got lucky enough to do that, got called over to the couch. And I swear to you, I remember laying in that little studio apartment up there behind the Santa Monica car wash, staring at the ceiling going, oh, crap, I don't have a plan now. That was it.
Right.
You know, and so, but again, that was okay. The one thing I did do is I worked at it. Mm-hmm. You know, like in those early days in the comedy club when everybody else was going out and getting drunk or high, I would come back from the show and I would take notes, and this worked and this didn't work. And I was always writing. I was always working at it. So while I didn't necessarily have a plan, and I look back, and so many of the people that are successful, they did work at it, whether it people like Judd Apatow, who was the house MC at the Comedy Magic Club, but you know, he was always kind of grinding and always kind of working. You didn't know who would have known then that he would end up making movies, but he worked at it. You know, Leno worked at it. Seinfeld worked at it. I mean, so, you know, there were a lot of people that ended up being successful at a lot of different things, whether it was TV shows or voiceovers or, you know, but they worked. You worked at it. You didn't see this coming, but you were always working at your craft.
Brian, you got a last question for Mr. Foxworthy?
Yeah, Jeff, it reminded me when you said that you know, to your theory or your hypothesis that, you know, you come out of the womb funny and then you can develop it. I remember you were in a documentary about 10 years ago called I Am Comic. And I remember this moment so well because Jeff is not only naturally funny, you're also a technician, and you were going on about how, and this is something that only, you know, the people with the musical mind understand music, or the people with the comic mind understand comedy. You were going on about how there's a rhythm to jokes, like ba-da, 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 boom. Or, you know, you can have ba-da, 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 and then ba-da, boom. Or there was a verbal rhythm that you had in your head. It's not every one of your jokes, but it sort of guides, you know, how you look at developing comedy or developing material.
And it's instinctual. It's not even, it becomes very hard to explain. It's like, how do you know? You know, but it's probably no different than throwing a baseball or catching a football. It's just an instinctual thing. But and I have a hard time describing it, but there's some nights when I'm on stage and I'm a visual guy, and I just think about that record with the needle being right in the groove, and there's some nights where it's not right in the groove, and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Am I going too fast, too slow? What am I? And then there's some nights, man, when it's just so perfect, and it's just must be like a skier going down a hill where you're not even thinking about it, you know? Well, and it's just, you're just on and it's working.
I hope there's no one under 40 listening, because all we've talked about cassettes and we've talked about records, and they're all going, I don't get the fuck these guys are talking. I haven't heard of either. I don't know either one of those analogies. Jeff Foxworthy, What It's Worth. It's premieres Tuesday, August 4th, 9 p.m. on A&E. Thanks, Jeff. Always good to talk to you, my friend.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me. Be well.
You too. One of the good ones, Jeff Foxworthy. All right, we're going to do a quick spot here, and then we'll bring on Maria Konnikova. First, I'll tell you about Madison Reed Mister, working from home, starting staring at your coworker's gray hair on the video calls, thinking about coloring it. You're not alone. Madison Reed Mister, gray blending natural color for your hair and for your beard. I've seen the before and after shots. I actually did it this morning. I put a little in. It's pretty easy. It comes with a set of rubber gloves. put the color in and just kind of rub it around your hands and just kind of put it in your hair like you're putting in pomade, and then put in the activator after that. It's a second little Mylar pouch, and you rub that around and hit it and let it sit for 10 minutes, and then you hit the shower, and there you go. Bob's your uncle. Works beautiful. Looks very natural. Madison Reed Mister makes it easy to find the color to match and find it on their website. Quick and easy to apply. You do the whole thing in under 10 minutes. Madison Reed Mister, right, Dawson?
Go to MadisonReedMister.com. That's MadisonReedMR.com. And use code Adam for 10% off plus free shipping on your first box. Again, that's code Adam.
Adam, also, just a heads up to anybody wanting to try Madison Reed, the first 10 people to email us their receipts will get a signed copy of your new book. Email us questions at AdamCarolla.com.
Yeah. So you have something to do while you let the hair dye sit and work its magic.
Exactly.
There you go. All right, Maria Konnikova is a writer, psychologist, professional poker player.
And, fascinating.
A very interesting person, New York Times bestseller. I got lots of books and translated into 17 different languages, one of her books. All right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Maria right after this.
For just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Dick, it's time for a brand new month of Adam's Monthly Nut. This shipment includes a bug bite thing to suck out any mosquito bites you get while drinking Mangria in the summer sun. A you can frisbee here frisbee, perfect for tossing at the beaches Newsom won't let you go to. An ACS koozie to keep your beer cold, and most importantly, let people know that this beer is yours. A ready patch for those who get a little rosy from drinking too many cold beers. And, of course, a bottle of your choice. This $60 value is yours for only $25. Order one or keep the shipments coming at CorollaDrinks.com. It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Ace, it's Mike from Florida. I know you're upset about the New York Times and Sundance and all that stuff, Oscars, but you know what? Fuck them. It's a bunch of, to quote Bill Burr, it's a bunch of adults giving each other trophies. So fuck them. You don't need it. Your stuff's great. Fucking keep doing what you're doing. And I'll keep listening. All right, man. See you.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And speaking of books, Maria Konnikova is with us. She's a writer, psychologist, professional poker player. I already told you about that. The book, The Biggest Bluff, How to Learn to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. It's available now on Amazon. It's exploration of how to use chance and odds to improve our lives. Oh, I'm very interested in this. Nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
So let's talk about how to use chance and odds to improve our lives.
Let's talk about it. Our lives are made of two elements, or at least so I've come to think. They're skill. They're the things that we control. They're the things that we actually have power over and that we can do. And then there's chance, which is just variance, noise of the universe. It's the stuff that happens to us, and we don't have any control over that. And I really started thinking about this seriously a few years back when I had a run of bad luck in my life. And I think that's what happens to most people. When things are going well, you don't really think about chance. You're like, yeah, I deserve this. I worked hard. You know, things are great. Things are going well. When things don't go well, that's when you start suddenly realize that a lot of the things you thought were you were actually just the universe being really nice to you and being like, yeah, okay, you're fine. You know, you're healthy today. Everything's good. Everything's great. You should be thankful, but you're not really thankful until things don't go your way.
Well, and yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was sort of just thinking people chalk a lot up to chance or luck or unlucky, you know, but what percentage, it's an unknowable question, but what percentage of car accidents where the person says, "I wasn't my fault. I was just driving along the highway and someone plowed in me." What percentage of those would be avoidable if that person was really doing all they could do. If they were really kind of head on a swivel, had a full night's sleep the night before, weren't looking at a phone or doing anything. What percentage? I bet you could cut the had nothing to me. I had none of my fault. The insurance company said it was 100% the other guy's fault. I bet 50% of those would be avoidable if that person was taking kind of control of their own, what we would call chance and luck.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Adam. I think you've actually just nailed it. And that's what brought me to this book. And that's what brought me to the game of poker, which I had never played before, and went from, you know, having zero interest in it, not knowing how many cards were in a deck, to actually going pro and winning international titles and doing this for a few years as part of my journey. But poker really teaches you how you can tell the difference between the process and the outcome, between the things you control, the things you don't control, and how you can really focus on the former. So in the case of car accidents, obviously that's not a game. Poker's a game, right? So let's draw a line and realize that we're learning about things in a controlled environment, and then life is much noisier and messier, and it's much more difficult to answer your question. In poker, you really can tell, okay, you know, I was a 75% favorite, so the 25% happened, and you know you made the right decision, and you know what was chance and what was skill. And in real life, you can't do that sort of calculus, but what you can start figuring out is a lot of the times where poker players are bitching to you and saying, oh, I can't believe this happened. You know, I can't believe this guy beat me and my aces got cracked and that happened. They made a mistake. They made a bad decision, and it's actually on them. And they put themselves in a bad situation. They didn't get unlucky. They behaved incorrectly. They didn't pay attention. They weren't looking at all of the information. They didn't do their homework. And that's actually the crucial lesson. Not how do you always get lucky, but how do you learn to pay attention? How do you learn to focus on yourself, on your environment? How do you learn to actually take in the right information so that you can then answer the question, was it me or was it chance? Did I make a bad decision or did I get unlucky? Did I make a good decision? This is something that people don't often ask. Or did I get lucky? That also happens a lot. Sometimes we make a really bad choice, a really bad decision, and then we luck out and we're like, yeah, I'm a genius. I'm brilliant. This is great. You know, I knew this was going to happen. No, you didn't. You made a really bad mistake. You shouldn't do that again. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Brian has a question as well, I think. I was going to say, we are much too quick to kind of remove ourselves from the outcome or the event. You know, we go, this thing happened to me. You know, it starts as a kid. You go, don't blame me. I wasn't even there. You know, there's a lot of like, don't look at me. There's nothing I could have done. There's way too many proclamations about there's nothing I could have done. By the way, there's almost always something that person could have done. But what I'm saying is, like, why do you want to externalize that much? You're losing control of your life. I mean, what if 75% of what happens to you, you go, it wasn't my fault. There's nothing I could do about it. Well, then there's nothing you can do about 75% of your life. Why even put that out to the universe?
Well, so you don't want to externalize. So there's a concept that I write about in the book, and that's comes from psychology. And it comes from the work of a guy named Julian Roeder. And it's called the locus of control. And there are two types of locus of control, internal and external. Internal is I am an agent. I do things. So I make things happen. External locus, things happen to me. So you switch the framing, right? Things happen to me. It's not my fault. You know, it's not, I got unlucky. Like this happened, that happened. And it's a very different way of looking at the world and a very different way of describing it. What you should strive for most of the time is an internal locus. So both poker and internal locus, it's a very Stoics game. It's very much kind of the philosophy of Stoicism in the sense that focus on the things that you can control. Because you want to actually reclaim agency. So focus on the process, focus on you, focus on your decisions, focus on your reactions, on your actions, on your emotions, on how you control your emotions, on how you choose to frame events. That's also a choice. You know, did I do this or did it happen to me? That's a very conscious choice that's going to affect how you are able to deal with events. And I think people who are more successful, people who are more emotionally resilient, who are able to get through things, are people with a much more internal locus, who actually know how to take even things that happen to them and say, okay, but here's where my agency is. So what I'm saying isn't, oh, you know, get rid of that 75%, but try to learn to tell the difference. Because if you keep focusing on the outcome, then you're actually not focusing on the things that you can control, because you can't control the outcome most of the time, right? It's something where you made a decision, but the outcome isn't up to you. There are other factors involved. So if it doesn't go well, it doesn't mean that you made the wrong decision. So you have to say, okay, this didn't go well, but I made the right decision. So I should keep doing this, and I should do it again, and I should try again, and I should hope for a different outcome next time. That's what I mean, as opposed to, oh, forget it. Let's get rid of agency.
Well, think about just this example that I hope we're all super guilty of. You think about something you cannot control at all, which is like your genes, you know? Yeah. So some people have a big nose. Some people are bald, Brian. Some people got their mom's birthing hips like I do.
How dare you?
Know? Every single time, probably I've ever seen myself naked in the mirror since 14 and a half, I've went, oh, look at your mom's big hips. I don't think I'm a bad person, but I go, look at that. I hate that. Or some people go, I hate this male pattern baldness, or I hate my fill in the blank. They look at them, women, men, everything. They look in the mirror and they see this thing, you know, and they go, God, I hate this about me. And that's all genetics, and it's nothing you can touch or change. I mean, obviously there's cosmetic surgery, but I'm saying, like, if you're a guy and you're short and you just wake up every day and you go, God, I hate better. Every time you stand next to a guy who's 6'5", you go, oh, shit. I mean, think about what we all do just aesthetically and physically with sort of genes that we really have no control over and can't really change. And yet we still dedicate a decent amount of thought to this thing that you cannot touch or change. You know, look, I have skinny calves. Every single time I put on shorts, I leave the house, I look down, I go, look at you with your skinny calves. Now, I don't do anything about it, and there is nothing to do about it. So it would seem a waste of time to even consider it. And I'm a pretty rational atheist, and yet I'll do that all the time. So we're kind of wired for it in a weird way.
We absolutely are. And I think it's very psychologically healthy to care about those things. I mean, agency is important. And I think that it's actually, you know, saying, oh, I don't care about, you know, I can't do anything about this, so I don't care about this in all elements is really, I think, just giving up way too much control. And so, yeah, we do that. And I think that's totally fine. And that's good, because you should care about yourself, and you should figure out, yeah, I can't do anything about my genes, but I can care about what I do. I can actually affect how I act and the choices I make. And that's what I think when we're talking about things we can't control that we shouldn't be focusing on, it's more the things that happen as a result of our choices, but that weren't up to us. So, like, let's take a very, very different example. So what I'm talking about is more about decision-making. So, like, let's say you were put in charge of a company. And the reason you were put in charge of a company is because you have a really great track record as a CEO, right? And so you have this great plan and you really think through it. And then COVID happens and the environment changes completely. And all of a sudden, all of the turnaround that you wanted to make can't happen. And your numbers start slipping. And the board is like, you know what? This guy sucks. Let's get rid of him. That's not something that is actually based on your performance, but they're judging you based on an outcome that might be totally irrational because it had nothing to do with you. And so what I'm saying is that outcome in that particular situation does not equal process. It doesn't equal, oh, you're a bad CEO. The opposite could happen. You could be tapped and become a CEO and the company does amazingly well and you made really shitty choices. And so, but you got really, really lucky because the industry was just taking off and you were along for the ride. And then another company says, hey, you did so well, come and run our company. And you just run it into the ground because you're a shitty CEO. And once again, you were judged on an outcome that had nothing to do with you. It's easier to see it when the example is external and not you.
Brian and Gina, why don't you guys ask away?
Gina, go ahead.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, you had a podcast called The Grift, right?
Yes.
This okay. is Grift. I loved it.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And I think I've listened to all of them, if not most of them. And I don't even know if this is answerable, but something tells me you'll provide some sort of satisfying answer. So when we talk about, you know, deceit and manipulation and things like that, sometimes those tools can be used for good. Sometimes they can be evil. And I'm wondering if you found some sort of a theme that motivated people to use their powers for evil, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you phrased it that way, because a lot of people are like, oh yeah, you know, this is a con, you know, you're lying. And then when I got into poker, they're like, bluffing is bad. You're lying. Like, wait, you know, like, let's put things in context here.
Right, exactly.
And let's realize that none of these things inherently have any valence, right? It's not like they're positive or negative. It's all in the intent, and it's all in the person who uses them. So is there something that motivates people to go in an evil direction? Yes and no. So what I always say, and I think this is true of most things, that con artists are both born and made, and there's nothing that will predispose you to be a con artist. Like, this is your fate. This is your destiny. And you are going to definitely persuade people for evil. That doesn't happen. I don't believe in that. Even psychopaths go on to have very productive lives and often don't even know they're psychopaths. I actually met this guy who was a neuroscientist and who found out that he was a psychopath because he did a brain scan of his own brain and saw that turns out that he's a psychopath, but he's a neuroscientist and had no idea. He just happened
That's one route to self-awareness.
So that's one route to self-awareness. Well, apparently his wife was like, I'm not surprised. You've got issues with emotions. So there's no such, like, genetics is definitely not destiny. And it's not like, oh, you are someone who's going to be evil. I think that you do need to have a predisposition, though, because if you put two people in the exact same situation, one of them might be inclined to start bending the rules a little and seeing like how far they can push the envelope and what they can do. Like, can I actually, you know, get this person to do something? And it turns out, yes, I can. Oh, now let me push it further and let me go even further. And before you know it, we've got a con artist. Whereas the other one, it wouldn't even occur to them. They're like, no, I just don't do this. So you need both things coming together. And so you can't predict necessarily what's going to take place. But I think that you can sometimes stop it when you don't have those circumstances. But oftentimes con artists will just, after the fact, justify what they did. But really, like, the circumstances came up and they're like, yeah, I want to do
this. I saw an opportunity.
Exactly. Like, one of the guys who I didn't get a chance to meet because he died in 91, who was one of the greatest con artists of all time, Ferdinand Waldo Damara, known as the Great Imposter. Tony Curtis played him in a movie. And I wrote about him, and he, over 30 years, pretended to be so many different people, much more successful than Abagnale, who we all know because of Leonardo DiCaprio and Catch Me If You Can. But this guy did it for decade after decade. And he was, you know, doctor, lawyer, performed surgery, founded a religious college that actually still exists, got a contract to build a bridge in Mexico. Luckily never built it. But this guy was a high school dropout. And I did so much work about him and so much research and looked at so many files. And he would always say that, you know, a lot of what he was because he had a traumatic childhood. He came from a wealthy family that suddenly lost their money because their movie theater business went under. And then his sister, who was his best friend, died in a freak accident when she was skating and hit her head on the ice and blah, blah, blah. And people really felt horrible for him. And I put all of this in the book. And then it turns out I had to do some fact checking after the fact when the book already came out. He probably didn't have a sister. So I was finally able to get birth records. And so he made up the sister, and the movie theater business did not belong to his family. It belonged to his uncle's family. So he just totally made up the entire backstory to justify what he did. Wow. And really, he just wanted to use the powers of deception for real.
Brian.
Before I get to my question, that's so funny. I was doing research on psychopaths versus sociopaths, so I don't know as much as you, but like the array of personality traits and the components that come together could create Hannibal Lecter or could create like a great sports agent. You know what I mean? It's like depends on if you want to go the good or the evil route, and there's obviously factors sure. involved in there, but these are the same people.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I always say, so there's the so-called dark triad of traits, which is psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. And I always say that they're overrepresented in con artists, but they're also overrepresented in lawyers, in businessmen, in a lot of other professions. So make of that what you will.
My actual question, I did a lot of research on your story. I found it very fascinating. As a very, very, very amateur poker player, I was interested in what did you find in your short but intense journey to professional poker, what was more advantageous for you, your psychology background or actually learning like the game of poker, math, things like that, which is obviously crucial, but what ended up being more beneficial for you?
The psychology. I mean, my last math class was in high school. And so I knew, I mean, I count on my fingers. I still count on my fingers. I'm no longer embarrassed to say it because now I've written it down in the book so people know about it. But I still do. And I always knew that I could not compete with the math guys on their level. But I had to learn pot odds. I had to learn the basic math. Mm-hmm. Of course I did. But I think when you're looking for your edge in any field, you need to figure out, you know, what is actually the stuff where I can excel, where I can beat people. And I realized very early on that that's people. I mean, my background is psychology. That's what my PhD is. And I know the science of decision-making. I know how to actually put words on what I'm seeing. And that's very powerful because if you have mental frameworks for actually conceptualizing things, then it helps you see the world a little different. It helps you see more nuance instead of black and white. And I was just, I think, always aware of the dynamics happening at the poker table. And to be perfectly honest, that's also what interested me. And I think that's so important. Where your interest is often the stuff that you're good at. And so that's where I was able to really excel.
Okay, so follow-up question then. When you say dynamics at the table, are you talking about literally like betting patterns? Or are you talking about, you know, the guy that wears sunglasses and a hat and headphones and is kind of out of it, you know, as like you said, stoicism? What is the dynamics of the table you're talking about?
Both, but a stoic would never be wearing headphones and glasses and be out of it. He'd be very attentive.
Good point, but you do see that sometimes. So
you do, you do. No, and I think that it's, I think both of the things are important because betting patterns tell you something about the person, especially if you're paying attention to dynamics. So dynamic change, what has changed? Are they betting more after a loss? Are they betting less after a loss? Are they taking more risks after they win? Are they taking fewer risks after they win? What's their risk-taking propensity? You know, how do they change? How do they let things irrationally affect them? Because everyone does. So there's a word that I learned in the poker world, tilt, which is such an awesome word. And I think that everyone should use it everywhere in life. And it's letting your emotions into your decision process. And every single person tilts. Unless you're a psychopath, then you probably do not go on tilt. But there's things that can still anger you. So the most important thing is to try to figure out, you know, what is this person's behavioral signature, behavioral pattern? How do they react to certain things? Are they taking it personally? Like, do they actually think that, you know, that guy in the sunglasses and the headphones who's raising them every time, are they taking it personally? Are they kind of looking over and saying, oh my God, I'm going to get you? Well, then they're going to be irrational. They're not actually going to be making good decisions. They're going to be making personal decisions. Be like, you know what? My favorite thing in the world is when someone looks at me and it says, next time you've been raising me every hand. Next time you raise, I'm going all in. I'm like, great. Wonderful.
Oh, I know.
Sounds good.
Thanks for the tip.
Yeah, I like this part about sort of paying attention and trying to tune in and tune into yourself and tune into those around you. And I feel like a lot of people don't know themselves. Most people, the people around them could tell them much more about them than they know about themselves.
And they deny it. No, I don't.
They would definitely deny it. I mean, look, if you if you went into any sort of office community and you'd go, who's most likely to be late if we were taking a bus up to the mountain resort or something? They'd all agree on one guy's or one girl's name. And who's most likely to insist on paying the bill when we get to the resort and we all go to dinner that night? Then they would all agree on it. It would be another person, most likely, but they'd all agree on it. Like, we all, everyone kind of knows what everyone else is up to. What if you had that, you're a little more insightful about yourself and you studied yourself? And how does one study themselves? How do you begin that process?
That is such a good question. And it's, I think you've kind of hit at the heart of why it's often so difficult to pay attention, because the first person we need to learn to pay attention to is ourselves. And we don't do that very often. I mean, how many people actually just sit down with themselves and say, okay, you know, okay, Maria, let's do a self-inventory. What's important to you? What motivates you? What things are you afraid of? How do you react in these situations? Like, how do you react in these situations? What's your profile in this, in that? We don't normally do that. And this is actually a theme that cuts through both con artists and poker. So the two things we've been talking about, because the reason that con artists are often able to trick people and kind of sell their version of the world is they understand you better than you understand yourself. They figure out what motivates you, how to press your buttons, and they actually will sell you the version of the world, not the real version of the world, but the one that you already believe in. They will sell you your biases and what you already want to be true. And so you just nod along and you're like, yeah, this seems right. And when we look at the psychology of self-assessment, we see that people are really, really bad at doing this kind of thing for themselves. So if you give someone a little quiz, you say, okay, rank yourself on these personality traits. Chances are most people have a what's called an optimism bias or a better than average effect. And so they're going to rank themselves as higher on the good traits, like friendly. Yeah, you know, I'm a friendly person, blah, blah, blah. And lower on the bad traits, like most likely to be late to when we're leaving on the bus on our friend trip. No, that's not going to be me. And then if you give that same assessment to their friends, they're going to actually agree with each other. And it's going to be very different from what you did yourself. And the only people for whom this isn't true are the clinically depressed. They actually see themselves pretty accurately. They see warts and all. And so you start realizing that this sort of blissful ignorance is blissful, and it actually can help us with psychological health. That said, I think that a little delusion goes a long way. And it's really, really important to actually take the time to try to seriously think about that for yourself, because it matters. And in situations that matter, having a better sense of your own characteristics, your comfort levels with risks or whatever it might be, is going to be incredibly helpful. And the way you do that, I think, is twofold. One, you do actually have to sit down and do this. Most people won't sit down with a pen and paper and actually write down things about themselves. But I think you do. You actually need to take the time to do this. And the way you would do it about someone else. I'm not saying that you do that about all your friends, but you do think about other people more than you think about yourself. And the other thing, at least, that works for me is a constant mindfulness practice. So I actually do meditate every single day. And I think that it teaches you to pay attention to yourself, to your breath, to your thoughts, to what your body's telling you, to what your mind's telling you. I mean, think about how often you find yourself thinking about something and you have no idea how you got there. Like, what steps did my mind take to actually get to this specific thought I'm having right now? Because it's totally unrelated to what I'm doing. Or the proverbial standing in front of an open fridge and forgetting why you're even there. It happens all the time. And it's not because we're suddenly forgetful. It's because we're constantly having this inner monologue that we're not listening to because we're just used to it and it's noise. Well, it's actually a skill to learn to start paying attention to that internal monologue so that you can trace your thought process back. And doing that exercise helps you really figure out a lot about your mind, about how it works, about the associations it makes, about the things that are important to it, the memories that are important to it, the way that it actually jumps from point A to point B. And you suddenly start being aware of your internal chatter And that tells you a lot about yourself. And then you're able to control it better. Then you're able to actually see, wait, you know, I'm being emotional, but that has nothing to do with the situation. I'm actually still pissed at that phone call I had an hour ago. And that's completely clouding my judgment in this situation. That's such an important insight to have. And it's an insight that most people lack about themselves. It's not easy. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a guru at doing this. Like, I'm shitty at doing it quite often, just because it's much easier to talk about it and to say how important paying attention and being present is. But it's hard. It's really hard. It's much easier to just let your mind drift and to be doing a lot of things at once. But I always preach of the benefits, even though I might not always do it, of unitasking, of actually just focusing on one thing at a time, of teaching your mind the importance of just being present and choosing one thing to do. So not having 50 million tabs open on your browser, not checking in on all social media feeds at the same time, but actually just learning to say, okay, well, right now we're just having this conversation. So I don't have my phone. I don't have this. I don't have that. I'm just focused. Most of the time, we're not doing that. Most of the time, even when we're talking to a friend, we're not doing that. Our mind's already thinking about, you know, what we're going to have for dinner and what we're doing next. And
what we're just waiting to say back to them.
Yeah. Exactly.
So we can get our point in.
Exactly. And then you're not listening. Because you're actually, if you're thinking about what you're going to say, you're not listening to what they're saying. That's something I picked up from con artists. Con artists know how to listen. They actually listen when you talk to them because they need it. That's their bread and butter. That's how they're going to get you.
That's how they're mining you.
You can only
read improvisers. You know what I mean? They don't know what they're going to get from the mark. They just got to work with it.
You can always tell when you're talking to someone if you ever get in the habit of, like, sometimes I'll go on a walk. Oftentimes I'll go on a walk and I'll call Dr. Drew and we'll have these really stimulating conversations about what's going on in the world. But if he ever starts checking emails or something on his phone, I can hear it drop. It's better. It's almost better than watching. You can hear it. You know, it's a little cadence change, little shorter answers. The talk was like a ping pong game where you're just going back and forth and back and forth. And now it's a ping pong game where I've hit it four times in a row and it's not coming back. And you can tell immediately he's just looking, he's checking something. His wife sent him a text, you know, she wants to know what time at the restaurant tonight. And I'm not even judging it, although it sounds like I am. I can just hear the disengagement. There's immediate disengagement.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. That's and true, so, yeah. So the one thing that we know about our minds, and this is what you're picking up on, is our minds are actually incapable of multitasking. Yeah. Multitasking is a myth. Doesn't exist. What our minds know how to do is switch between tasks. And so when you think you're multitasking, like, oh, you know, I'm just checking my phone and listening to you. If you're the moment you're actually reading that text from your spouse, you're not listening. You're not fully engaged. And you can pick up on that. It's so funny that you say this because I have the exact same conversations with my mom where I can tell exactly. I'm like, all right, mom, like, what's going on? you're not. And she always denies it. She's like, no, I'm listening. I'm like, no, you're not. I could have just told you that, you know, I'm about to step out, you know, in the middle of the highway, and you'd be like, yep, sounds great. Sounds like a great idea.
No, the phone is not on. The TV is not on. I'm listening to you.
Yeah. Let me recreate that phone call. So it's me going, Jesus Christ, it's 90 degrees outside and Gavin Newsom has shut down the horse trail behind my house. Like, I'm going to get COVID from walking down the horse trail, 90 degrees in the middle of the summer.
Right.
Yeah, you're damn right. I'm right. I mean, I'm angry. I'm fired up. We can't keep this city shut down. This is insanity. People are losing their businesses. They're losing their livelihoods.
Crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's nuts. It's cuckoo is what it is. And I got to tell you, man, people are snapping. I think there's going to be a lot of vigilante justice here against the government. I feel like people are going to start opening their stores. They don't care if they're. You can't arrest all of us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting on a plane. I'm going to Texas. I'm getting on a goddamn Southwest plane. I'll wear the mask. Sure, I'll wear the mask. That's the rule. But as soon as I get into that bathroom, I ain't wearing that mask. And they don't know if I'm wearing a mask in that Southwest bathroom or not inside that 737.
Right, right.
Yeah, but Drew, are you focused totally on what I'm saying now? I feel like you're staring at your phone. Are you texting with your wife?
No, the phone is not on. The TV is not on. I'm listening to you.
You're listening, but I'm getting these one syllable answers from you. I just don't feel like you're tuned in. That's all. That's all you have to say to my soliloquy. And scene. Yeah, that's what Dr. Drew sounds like when you try to do a podcast with Dr. Drew and he's in New York, he's looking at his computer the whole time or answering texts. That's literally what he sounds like. He doesn't know it, but his cadence drops. Oh,
sometimes I do. Well, I'll tell you what.
Sometimes he does know it. You're right. Yeah, so I will say this, something I was thinking about when you were speaking early on, is my batting average of stuff that was bad happening to me was much higher at a different point in my life. There was a lot of, I got another parking ticket and my tools got stolen from my truck and I can't find my keys and like all these little dumb sort of why me or woe is me moments were happening quite consistently in my life. And they don't happen very often anymore because I'm like, when I get up, if I'm at the airport and we're waiting for the plane, we have a beer at the cafe and then we get up, I'm like patting myself down. Where's my phone? Where's my earbuds? Where's my boarding pass? Like, I'm not moving from this table. I'm not just going to start. I'm trouncing down the terminal. And I've realized that I have eliminated so many sort of chicken shit nuisances of, oh fuck, I left my keys back in the whatever. I've eliminated so many of these things just by having a little protocol, like just having a little system, like just stupid stuff. Even when I go to the airport and I park at the airport parking lot, I take my car keys and I put them on my car tire quite often because I don't want my keys going with me to Denver and then off to Houston, and then coming back, because there may be a point where I'm opening that backpack when I'm back in L.A., and I go, fuck, I took the keys out of my, when I was looking for whatever in my backpack in the hotel in Houston, I threw them out on the table, and I want to eliminate, like, first things first, just eliminate as much shit as you can eliminate. If you don't need your keys for your car in Denver and Houston, do not bring them with you to Denver and Houston. Yes, Maria, sorry.
No. I think that's absolutely right. I think that you want to take as much agency as you can to eliminate as much of that little stuff as possible. And that's all about presence and vigilance and attention, all these things we've been talking about. And their flip side is also true. There's a study that I absolutely love that was done by this guy, Richard Wiseman, a psychologist in England. And he gathered a bunch of people, and some were people who considered themselves lucky, and some were people who considered themselves unlucky. So he actually just put out a call and said, hey, like, Do you think of yourself as lucky? Do you think of yourself as unlucky? And so he had these people go through a newspaper, and they were supposed to look at and report back on the number of photographs in that newspaper. And the so-called lucky people took a matter of seconds, and the unlucky one took multiple minutes. And the only difference between them was on the second page. The lucky ones had noticed something. There was some text, some big letters that said, stop counting. And it told them how many photographs there were in this newspaper. And the unlucky ones just didn't see it because that wasn't even a picture. And so they limited what they were paying attention to. They actually limited their scope. They limited their awareness, and they ended up missing something really, really important. So I think what you're talking about is super important and goes both ways, right? So you can eliminate as much of the bad stuff as you can. And then that same presence, that same kind of active mindset can make you quote unquote luckier because you're actually going to spot things that other people miss. He did another study where he had money on the floor and the lucky people actually saw it and the unlucky people didn't. And the unlucky people are like probably thinking, oh, that never happens to me. You know, I never find a $100 bill on the floor. You're never looking. You're too much in your head thinking, man, I'm so unlucky. You know, I'm just, you're focused on other stuff.
God forbid that narrative is challenged. You almost don't want that narrative to be challenged.
Exactly. And I think it's so important to take control of those little things because the bad shit, like the real bad luck, like, you know, God forbid, you know, you get cancer or a really horrible disease. That's something that you're going to need all of your resources to deal with. And that's something that isn't like losing your keys. So why don't you try to eliminate all the little stuff and be lucky in all the small ways? Because you can't control the really big stuff, and better be as prepared as you possibly can just in case. And hopefully it doesn't, but just in case something like that does come along.
Yeah. My feeling is there's plenty of stuff. There's a kind of a basket we all have of things we can't control. You know, I can control my keys going with me to Denver, but I can't control an engine catching on fire on a Southwest flight. But there's a basket of things you can't control, but in that basket is a bunch of stuff you can control. You just don't think you put it in the wrong basket. And my feeling is thin that basket out. There are handfuls of things, good and bad, you truly can't control. But let's have it be as little as possible in that particular basket. And you'd be surprised, once you really analyze things, how many items in that basket of things you thought you can't control actually could have made it its way into the basket of things you can control.
Beautifully said. I completely agree. And I think we need to work on building that basket of things that we're controlling. Because there are the things that the things we truly can't control. Let's bring them down to the essentials. You know, I end my book with a toast that my family has that we always say first before we toast to birthdays or holidays or whatever it is we're celebrating. It's in Russian, but I'll say the English version. It's "May everyone be healthy." And that's kind of that's what we always start every single family gathering and meal with, because that's something that, sure, you can control a lot of things about your health. You know, you can have a healthy lifestyle, you can make choices, you can exercise, you can eat well, all these things. But then there are the genes, the things that you and I were talking about, and the environmental influences that we don't know enough about that we truly can't control. And so we always just say that first, may everyone be healthy. And as long as you have that, you can control almost everything else.
Well, there's control within control, even exactly. Without things you can't control. So Brian has a brain tumor that he was not in control over whether he got that or not. But he is doing the keto diet and he is focusing on, you know, medication, and he's focusing on rehab,
physical therapy,
and physical therapy. There's lots within the thing he can't control. You know, once that thing happens to you that you can't control, that horrible accident or the brain tumor or the loss of a loved one or a child or something, it momentarily falls into the basket of things you can't control. Who could control your kid being killed by a drunk driver? And then goes right back to the basket of things you can control, how you react, what you do with your energy. Yes, Brian.
It's funny. When Marie was talking about people who consider themselves lucky or unlucky, I don't think of myself as inherently lucky or unlucky, but getting diagnosed with the brain tumor 11 years ago was pretty unlucky. That's one of the more unlucky things you can probably, you know, end up spinning the wheel on. However, I also look at myself as incredibly lucky because I was put on a new medication at the time and I responded really well to it, like not a lot of people do. And in that respect, it's been, you know, there's been some negatives to it, but it's also been a great, you know, I've been able to do things because of it that I would never have been able to do otherwise. And not just, you know, the recovery, but, you know, things that has led to opportunities. So in a sense, I guess it was a lucky, you know, lucky stroke.
I think that everything that the two of you are saying, it's So it just illustrates this crucial point of, you know, internal locus and actually being able to be an agent and take control of things and take control of your mental framings, because nothing is inherently bad. I mean, yes, a brain tumor is inherently bad, but then all of the other things, it's all in how you react and how you respond and what, how you construe it and the story, the narrative that you build around yourself and around what you were able and not able to do. And we know that there's a really strong connection between mind and body, and people who are more positive, who are more optimistic, who are thinking of things in that more constructive framework, not woe is me, poor me, but okay, what can I do? What do I do now? They have better recovery rates from a lot of things because we are able to influence a lot of what our bodies do. I'm someone who's very against pseudoscience, but there's so much documented evidence on this. This is not bullshit that our brain and our body have such a close link. And so I think that what you're saying, Brian, what you said, Adam, that's the crucial lesson. Yeah, shit's going to happen. So how do you respond to it? And how do you make sense of it? And how do you move on? And then what do you do? And what do you do with the rest of your life? I think that that's the question. And that's what distinguishes people. And I think it's crazy that it's wonderful that you're calling yourself lucky. A lot of people would be like, I would never call myself lucky in that situation. But that says a lot about who you are and what you're able to do. And I think that's amazing and inspiring.
A positive note to go out on. The book, The Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. It's available now on Amazon. And, if this pandemic has maybe taught us anything or given us the opportunity to do anything, it's to change up our patterns. Some of it's physical and sort of mechanical, but much of it is emotional and psychological. And if some good can come of this, maybe that's the good that'll come of it. We can all get off the hamster wheel long enough to do some real honest evaluating of ourselves, and then as we move forward, take that with us on the rest of life's journey. Website Maria Konnikova .com is where you can go. Well, that was fascinating, Maria. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My thoughts as well. All right, let me hit JB Weld, and then we'll take a break and do some news. JB Weld, DIY projects to get through. Want to save money? Want to avoid paying the repairman? Big or small repairs? Well, ordinary household glue. It's got the word ordinary in it. You need strong. There's nothing better than JB Weld. We're proud to have JB Weld as a sponsor. They're great. I know these guys. I know the owner. Hung out with him and at SEMA, went to his booth and just talked some two-part epoxy with the man. And now they've jumped on board as a sponsor. Proudly made in the USA. Keep JB Weld in your toolbox, kitchen drawer, craft room, metal, wood, plastic, or more. Don't glue it. JB Weld it. And it's available at jbweld.com, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, O'Reilly, Walmart, Amazon, Michaels, and more. All right, we'll take a quick break. Come right back with the news right after this.